Thanks for downloading a 3CR podcast. 3CR is an independent community radio station based in Melbourne, Australia. We need your financial support to keep going. Go to www.3cr.org.au for more information and to donate online. Now stay tuned for your 3CR podcast.
Freedom of Species would like to acknowledge the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation, who are the traditional owners of the land on which we broadcast today. We pay our respect to the elders of all of the lands on which we meet across Australia.
Animal liberation, animal liberation, world. Whoa, 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 whoa.
Welcome to Freedom of Species, the radio show that brings animal advocacy to the airwaves. That was Sally just finished up with Out of the Pan. Thanks, Sal. And that last track was Eric Johnson with Cliffs of Dover. And today, yeah, my name's Trevor and we've got Betty.
Hello, I'm Betty.
And Betty, yeah, what's the show for today?
Okay, so last time I was on here, I mentioned that I want to explore in my shows going forwards the way that military and international border systems are interacting with animals and nature.
Mm.
So today we're going to visit the first case study, which is the Korean Demilitarized Zone, also right. known as the Korean DMZ. So we got this one planned as a two-parter because it's going to be a pretty big topic and I'm hoping it'll be a jumping off point for lots of interesting conversations.
Yeah.
All right, so I'll start with the basic facts before I get right into the history. So this is a habitat and a zone that cuts right across the middle of the Korean Peninsula, over the border of North and South Korea, which is, of course, one of the most militarized and fortified national borders in the world.
Because they're still technically at war.
Yeah, it's still technically a war, but not currently fighting, or at least not in a large-scale way.
Yeah.
So This zone is 248 kilometres long from the Western Han River estuary to the East Sea.
Oh, wow.
So as a local reference point, that's the distance from Melbourne City to the bottom of Wilson's Prom.
Yeah.
And it's 4 kilometres wide over the border. So that's the size of the zone.
4Ks? That's a long. Yeah, it's quite a big.
So it's 2 kilometres either side of the border. Right,
right, like the border's right in the middle. Yep, so 2Ks either side.
Yeah, so imagine like a long strip across the middle of the Korean Peninsula.
Yep.
So obviously the Korean DMZ has a violent history, but in the past 71 years, it has become home to over 6,000 identified plant and animal species, many of which are severely endangered or even believed to be extinct elsewhere.
And so are there, like, do people, I know there's not, the general public aren't in the DMZ zone, but are there military doing a lot in the DMZ zone, or is it more, does it operate almost like a national park that's just sort of fenced off and no one's there?
So there is one village technically located in the DMZ, but it's not a place that anyone can just go.
Yeah.
It's highly, highly militarized. The military are going into some parts of the DMZ, but a lot of parts are not safe to go.
Right.
Because basically, because of landmines, and some of the minefields are kind of unconfirmed.
Gotcha.
So we'll be talking about that more in the future.
But it is almost like a national park in certain sections in a way. Like there's not like a national park, sorry, but just like a, not many humans are there. So.
Yeah, definitely not many humans are there. The idea of a national of it being a national park is actually extremely controversial.
Oh, right. Okay.
So we will talk about that because remember it's within a zone that's kind of not officially under the jurisdiction of either country.
Cool.
So calling it a national park kind of implies that someone owns it, right?
Yeah, whoops. I was more meaning like the conceptual idea of a national park in terms of like there's you know, focus on environment and not much human intervention, but no.
Yeah, I know what you mean, but like as we'll get into, it's probably best to not think of it that way.
Right, okay.
It's more kind of like an accidental nature reserve.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a much better term.
So just at a glance, it looks like the free-living animals are thriving here and they're completely indifferent to these political ideologies that they exist between. So do we think that this place of war and death somehow transformed into a place of peace and life? Let's slow down. Before we get further, I want to give some content warnings for this episode because I'm going to be talking about some pretty intense stuff, but not in a graphic way. I am going to be talking about war, colonization, and cultural genocide, particularly as it relates to the Second World War and the Korean War. So if you know anything about Korean history, you might know what I'm about to get into. Listener discretion advised for these topics. So once we got the background, I'm hoping that it'll open up some good discussions like, what is peace and who is peace for? And can we ever really heal the scars of war on the land, on the people, and on the ecosystems? So, yeah, what have I got myself into with this topic? It's going to be quite a journey. And, yeah, I'm going to bring you all along. Let's go.
And obviously, if any of our listeners, part two will be next week. But if you can't listen next week or if people aren't listening live, obviously it'll be on the podcast as well. So, yeah, strap yourself in for a two-part.
Yeah. So when I first became interested in this topic, I was really happy to find a great book in English. And that's kind of ended up being an important resource for me researching this one. So the book is called Making Peace with Nature, Ecological Encounters Along the Korean DMZ, and is by Korean-American anthropologist Alana J. Kim, and it came out in just 2022, so it's not that old. So she did her field research for the book between 2011 and 2016 along the boundaries of the South Korean DMZ, where she spoke and worked with ecologists, researchers, environmentalists, and residents living and working in the civilian control zone, which is just south of the DMZ proper.
Like the closest you can get.
Yeah, so the civilian control zone is a highly militarized civilian area, residential area. So I'm going to refer to her book a lot going forward. If you're really interested in this topic, I recommend reading the book. But if you don't want to do that, well, that's why I'm here, to share some of the ideas from it. So first, let's set the setting. Korea's geography, it's a small mountainous peninsula located west of China and east of Japan. And from a military and trade perspective, it's a rather useful peninsula to have control of. So you can imagine the neighbors and other outside powers have always been trying to gain control of the Korean peninsula. Like Russia, China, and Japan have all had imperial projects at various points in history, and Korea's always had to defend against that.
Right.
So Korea did have an isolationist period, which lasted for around 200 years, and the Joseon monarchy probably did this trying to keep out foreign influence and colonialism and, you know, French missionaries that they were having trouble with. But eventually, this just made Korea extremely vulnerable to invasions because they were technologically and diplomatically lagging behind the rest of the world.
Right. So how, when you say like isolated or like an isolation phase, you mean like no trade with other countries or?
Yeah, basically no trade and no one's allowed to visit.
Right.
So they're just trying to keep out foreigners.
Sort of similar to what North Korea is now in a way?
It's kind of hard to compare because of the time period.
Yeah.
Because there were other countries that had a go at having an isolationist period. For example, Japan had one before that.
Right.
But, yeah, North Korea's isolation in modern times, it functions quite differently, right. I would say. Yeah, at that time, I think Korea was kind of like a protectorate state of the Chinese Empire at the time that was next door, but they were operating as this isolated independent state.
Interesting.
But, okay, so now let's properly start the historical journey in the late 1800s. So think about what's going on in the world at this stage. British imperialism has been a scourge on the world for over a century now.
Yep.
There's colonial projects popping up everywhere. America is now also a rising imperial power. So Japan sees what Britain and America are doing, and they think, oh, we could do that too. So Japan decides to do imperialism and they force Korea out of their isolation, basically at gunpoint.
Right.
With the signing of the unequal Japan-Korea Treaty of 1876. So just to emphasize how much the Japanese were mimicking, I guess, Western colonialism, the treaty granted Japanese people many of the same rights that Westerners enjoyed in Japan at the time. such as something called extraterritoriality, which means they are exempt from the local laws. So the laws are based on who a person is rather than where they are. I don't know. It kind of reminds me of an early form of apartheid. Like there's one set of laws for the indigenous people and another set of laws for the colonizers.
Yeah.
So following the signing of that treaty, there was decades of war, intimidation, more land grabbing and political manipulation by Japan until Korea was formally annexed into Imperial Japan in 1910.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah, so at this stage, this is like the beginning of the expansion of Imperial Japan with Korea kind of as one of the first targets.
Right.
So the Japanese colonial period was a time of intense brutality for the Korean people. One of the most egregious acts of the occupation was the attempted eradication of Korean culture. The Japanese education system was imposed as a tool of forced assimilation, and the teaching of Korean language and history was banned in schools.
Yeah, wow.
By the late 1930s, the Koreans were even banned from having their own press and forced to adopt Japanese-style names. Does this sound kind of familiar?
Yeah.
So it wasn't a new idea. This is a similar kind of thing to what was done here in Australia and in Canada and in America, etc.
Yeah.
But like all people under colonization, the Korean people resisted. And as a result, Korean culture not only survived, but it went on to become internationally prolific as it is today.
Mm.
But that's getting a bit ahead. So now let's jump to 1945. So the United...
Because that was, just quickly before you do, that was before World War One that it became sort of under Japan rule. Just before,
I think it was annexed before World War One, and during the whole duration of World War One, it was under Japanese occupation. Yep. So it was 35-year occupation, 1910 to 1945.
Gotcha. And now we're at the end of World War II.
Yeah, so we're just getting to the end. The United States has only been involved in World War II for 4 years at this point. They joined in 1941, but they want to send a very clear message to Japan. The only nation that's allowed to do imperialism on this planet in this time period is America. And then they drop the atomic bombs on Hiroshima and Nagasaki, thus ending World War II, and the age of Japanese imperialism in East Asia, as well as the 35-year Japanese occupation of Korea.
Right, so that finished all of that.
Yeah, so that was the atomic bomb. And think about it, this was the first time that atomic bombs got used. So that is what ended the Japanese empire.
Mm.
So the Japanese colonial forces surrender in Korea. The Soviet Union comes in from the north, and America is now occupying Japan, and they come in from the south. So at this stage, end of World War II, the Soviet Union and the US are kind of allies against the Japanese and Nazi Germany. But it's not going to stay that way for much longer. They agree to divide Korea in half at the 38th parallel, and they take on occupational duties in the north and the south in their respective halves. So the divided Korea setup was only meant to be a temporary thing. But when the Soviet Union and the USA each withdrew in 1948, as they had agreed, they each left behind dictators that were ideologically aligned with their own nation's governments.
Yeah.
So what do you think happens? You've got pro-Soviet, pro-communist Kim Il-sung in the north and pro-capitalist, pro-American Syngman Rhee in the south, each proclaiming singular sovereignty over the entire peninsula.
Right.
So it's only 5 years after World War II has ended.
Yeah.
And then in 1950, the Korean War breaks out as the Cold War's first hot war. So the US, under Harry Truman, is not willing to let the Korean Peninsula fall to communism. So American and allies intervene and come and fight for the south. While China, under Mao Zedong, is not going to let it fall to capitalism, so they come in to support the North with eventual support from the Soviet Union.
So it's really similar to what happened later with Vietnam. It was like a precursor to it in a way.
Yeah, it's basically a proxy war between the United States and the Soviet Union.
Mm.
So a devastating and brutal three-year war is fought, and the exact human casualties are not known, but it's estimated that 3.8 million people were killed, and more than half were likely civilians. This war made little change to the national border, and there was no decisive victory for either side.
Hmm.
So finally, in 1953, a ceasefire agreement is signed. Not a peace treaty, just a ceasefire.
Mm.
Some American guys draw a border and both sides retreat back 2 kilometers from the military demarcation line, forming a buffer zone around the new border. And this becomes the Korean Demilitarized Zone. So it is demilitarized in the context of an ongoing war.
Right.
So the basic rules of the zone is no heavy artillery, no military stationed in the area, and limits to the number of soldiers from each side allowed within the DMZ at any given time.
Yeah.
So as a result of these rules, the area has been left almost entirely uninhabited and unvisited by humans for 71 years.
Yeah, wow.
Once it was a rice farming district in the heart of Korea, then it was a war zone, and now it's become this rare oasis of non-human life.
Mm.
Okay, so soon I want to come up to the first song, but this song I'm going to give a bit more kind of intro to.
Yeah.
So in this episode, I want to use music as a tool to tell some of the historical story. And because I think there's some ways that my words probably just can't really do it. So this song has a pretty amazing story. The lyrics were written by Korean inmates in a Japanese colonial prison in 1919. The chorus translates to, "Let the mountains tremble terrified. Let the sea boil up and dry. Great Korea is still alive." So to think about the historic context of those lyrics, these were written by people under a brutal colonial occupation that was attempting to wipe out their cultural identity.
Mm.
The lyrics are translated in the YouTube video, and I want to link that one in the show notes. But what I'm about to read is translated from the YouTube description and paraphrased and summarized by me. So immediately after the March 1st independence movement in 1919, 7 independence activists, including Yoo Gwan-sun, were imprisoned in cell number 8 of Yaksa Sandaemun prison for leading the March 1st movement. These women, who ranged from their teens to their 30s, composed and sung songs in prison to soothe their fears and inspire each other with courage. Songs of March again tells the hidden stories of activists who gave up everything for Korean independence and the unknown helpers who silently fulfilled their mission for them. This project confirmed the existence of a song written and sung in prison by Yoo Gwan-sun and her cellmates.
Mm.
A project in 2019 was planned to recreate the song based on the discovered lyrics. Anya Un, a singer-songwriter in her 20s, added the tune. The song captures the courageous will of those who prayed with blood and tears and said Korea survived. Rather than portraying her as a flower broken by a painful history, we wanted to emphasize her will as an activist who will not break even in death. Although their names did not remain in history, I hope that through this song, the spirit and courage of the determined women activists who sacrificed everything for Korean liberation would become more known. So this is Song of Cell Number 8, or Woman's March, by An Ye-eun.
Thank you. Beyond the Bars for NAIDOC Week 2024. Keep the fire burning, black, loud and proud. At 3CR, NAIDOC Week is a time we dedicate to hearing the voices of some of the most marginalised people in our society, Aboriginal women and men in the prison system. From 11 a.m. each weekday, Monday the 8th of July to Friday the 12th of July, we'll take you inside six Victorian prisons. Dame Phyllis Frost, Barwon, Fulham, Loddon, Marguerite and Port Phillip. Tune in to 8.55am, 3CR Digital, streaming online at 3cr.org.au or via Community Radio Plus app to hear stories, songs, opinions and poems from the men and women inside, connecting with culture and community with Beyond the Bars for NAIDOC Week 2024. 3cr.org.au / Beyond the Bars for all the details. Can't keep carrying on the changes coming.
The revolution in Rojava is a beacon of hope for the world, putting direct democracy and feminism into practice on a broad scale. This radical attempt at social transformation now faces huge challenges, including daily attacks by the Turkish military with little outside recognition or aid. Show your support for Rojava by joining Northeast Syria Solidarity, or NESS, and help ensure the survival of this inspiring experiment in social change. NESS sends aid, raises awareness, and builds solidarity. Get involved at www.nesssolidarity.org.au. NESS is a 3CR supporter.
Yeah, welcome back to Freedom of Species on 3CR this Sunday afternoon, and it's Trevor with Betty. And Betty, what was that last song we heard just before?
So that last song was Cell Number 8, Women's March by An Ye-un. So I recommend watching the YouTube video for that one if you want to see the full translation of the lyrics.
Yeah, and was that a live performance or was it sort of done for the music video thing on YouTube, do you know? Or?
Oh, so The YouTube video was a live recording,
yeah.
But I'm not sure if it was a performance in front of an audience, but yeah, it was but a live recording.
Yeah.
And I love that singer's voice. Like, it is so powerful for that song.
Yeah. So the first segment, we talked a bit about the history of Korea leading up to, I guess, what created the DMZ, because today's topic is about the demilitarized zone, the DMZ that separates North and South Korea. And just in that break, we were just saying that it's funny that, well, not funny, but it's interesting that a lot of what you were saying about the history of Korea is very similar to what we've seen in the history of, we were saying, say, Australia's colonial history, and also what's happening in Palestine now in terms of genocide or mechanisms involved and how that looks on the ground or how that affects their culture. And it's very telling to see that it's the same sort of almost like echoes of the exact same thing happening just in a different context.
Yeah, we see those same patterns kind of popping up all around the world when you start looking into the history.
Mm. But this second segment, what are we doing for this one?
So let's go back to talk about the DMZ and the wildlife in it. When I first heard about this whole situation, my immediate reaction was to think, well, this just shows that us humans really need to stay completely out of animal habitats. That was my first thought. But after I read Kim's book, I started to think about it a little bit differently, because whether we choose to see ourselves this way or not, and even if we're not entering a physical space, humans are already part of these ecosystems.
Mm.
And our infrastructures are part of these ecosystems. And that's actually what is creating the environments. Our infrastructures and our institutions are creating environments now.
Mm.
So the DMZ ecosystem, while it's surrounded by barbed wire fences and covered in landmines, it's not a bubble. It is greatly impacted by the actions of the humans to the north and the south and across the sea.
Mm.
So north, and maybe it's surprising, but actually not all human infrastructure is bad for wild animals. In fact, some has actually become essential for their survival.
Right.
So North and South Korea have each become rather inhospitable to wild animals for different reasons.
You mean the general areas of North and South Korea?
Yeah, like the whole country. And not just, I'm not singling out these countries. Quite a lot of nation states are generally inhospitable to wild animals. We're just kind of using this one as a case study.
Yeah.
So North Korea today is one of the most economically isolated countries in the world.
Mm.
Citizens of North Korea are frequently subject to shortages of food and other supplies. And this impacts animal habitats in a big way, because people tend to cut down trees for firewood and to make more agricultural land and to steal the eggs of wild birds as a source of food.
Mm.
And all the environmental impacts that come with deforestation, like landslides and floods and things like that.
Yeah.
In the south, immediately following the war, there was initially also habitat destruction from economic impoverishment, and later on it came from capitalist development and expansion. So while huge changes were occurring in both nations over the past 70 years, the DMZ remained as maybe the most consistent and reliable habitat for wild animals on the whole peninsula. With nowhere else to go, that's where they went.
Yeah. And I guess other countries we see, like, because change in land use, or I guess it's probably the best term to use it, will have different drivers. But as you say, like, that happens, and it's human-centric, or it's always driven by human-centric forces. So that is going to be the biggest impact to animals in those countries.
Yeah, definitely. The losses of their habitats. So for this next bit, I'm going to talk a bit about migratory birds and some of the people who carefully studied them. So this is a bit of a story, and it might put in more place like the historical setting and everything that's happening. So unsurprisingly, many species of migratory birds are finding seasonal homes in and around Korea's DMZ, including the red-crowned crane, who is very famous, considered an East Asian symbol of peace and long life. But birds in general are often used as a symbol of the absurdity of human-made borders. They just fly right over, literally and metaphorically above us and our silly geopolitics. But we can't get too caught up in that mythology, because birds do not enjoy limitless freedom from state power. In fact, because they're international travelers, that actually makes them more vulnerable at multiple locations.
Mm.
So one quote from the book: the birds are not unifying the divided nation, but are surviving in part due to, and also in spite of, militarized geopolitics.
Yeah.
Studying these migratory birds and protecting their habitats does require some kind of international cooperation. And that even includes cooperation with the so-called rogue states like North Korea. Ornithology is the study of birds, and the establishment of ornithology as a field of study in both Koreas is quite enmeshed with the geopolitical situation. So there is a man who's often recognized as Korea's first ornithologist, a man named Won Hong-gu. He was born in 1887 and he worked as a high school natural history teacher during the Japanese colonial period. He went on to study natural sciences in Japan and later published educational materials about Korean native birds. Of course, during this time, the research was led by Japanese settlers living in Korea who published their works in Japanese but relied on the indigenous knowledge of Korean natural scientists like Won Hong-gu and his colleagues. Still, Dr. Won made a name for himself and eventually became a leader and professor in the establishment of natural sciences at Kim Il-sung University in post-war North Korea. So it's fair to say if you wanted to know something about Korean birds at this time, Won Hong-gu is the guy you're going to ask. So Dr. Won had a son named Pyong-oh, who was born in 1929. Pyong-oh started out with a degree in agricultural sciences before his father encouraged him and his brothers to head to the south. When the war broke out in 1950, the Won family became one of hundreds of thousands of Korean families that were separated by the National Division, with no way to contact one another or to even know if their family members had survived. Immediately following the war, South Korea was one of the most economically impoverished nations on earth because the US-backed dictator, Syngman Rhee, at the time, his economic strategy was basically to just hold all the money for himself. So the citizens were not getting any money and South Korea was considered like a bottomless pit of aid money from the US. At that time, the North was probably in a somewhat better economic situation because they actually had retained some of the pre-war useful infrastructure that was built by Japan on their side of the border, and they also had the financial backing of the Soviet Union. So North Korean citizens probably had a better standard of living than South Koreans during the late 1950s and 1960s post-war decades.
Right.
So Won Pyong-oh is stuck in the South away from his parents and his sisters, but he ends up following kind of a similar path to his father. He goes to Japan to earn a doctorate in natural sciences. He comes back to South Korea and serving Kyung-i University, he leads the way in establishing the natural sciences, especially ornithology, in post-war South Korea. He trains the next generation of South Korean ornithologists and even earns himself the nickname Dr. Bird. Dr. Won Pyong-oh has funding from the US military for his migratory bird research. So he does a lot of banding the legs of birds to collect information on their migrations. And this is obviously a collaborative project with international ornithologists, banding and catching birds in their locations. So he's working out of South Korea, but the aluminum bands he uses are labeled with Japan, as that was where the nearest BirdLife International office was located at the time. In 1965, Won Hong-gu, the father, catches a Darien starling with a number-coded aluminium band and the word Japan inscribed. So this is Won Hong-gu in the north. Now, Won Hong-gu knows his shit, and he knows the Darien starling does not fly to Japan. So he contacts the Tokyo BirdLife office, and he finds out that the starling had been banded in Seoul a few years earlier by none other than his own son, Dr. Won Pyong-oh. And that is how Won Hong-gu found out 15 years after the war ended that his son had survived.
Wow.
So the migrating birds and the research into them provided a point of connection for an international community of humans during the Cold War, which included a separated father and son. This story became known and appropriated in various forms of propaganda by both the North and South as a symbol of the inevitability of reunification. However, despite the sporadic contact they were able to make through their international network of birds and natural scientists, Pyong-oh and Hong-gu never saw each other again. Hong-gu passed away in 1970, and the South Korean government didn't let Pyong-oh enter North Korea until 2002, long after both his parents were gone. So this is a quote from Pyong-oh, which he told the newspaper in 1993. "How endlessly envious I am of the birds who traverse the walls of the National Division. The collective attempts of dedicated humans to understand the behaviours of migratory birds spans across national borders and generations. Thanks to this research, today the flight patterns of migratory birds can be approximately represented by the International Flyway Charts. Have you ever seen those?
I haven't, but I can sort of imagine what they would be.
Yeah, so it's like you can see a map of the world, but instead of all our national borders, you just see the bird migration patterns.
Mm.
So it could be a way to kind of decenter and denaturalize the human perspective on geography.
Yes.
So the largest migration route is the East Asian Australasian flyway, which is used by 40% of the world's migratory birds. The distances that they fly is really incredible, actually. It's hard for me as a human to imagine how they do it. So one ornithologist that Alan Akim worked with had a quote that I liked, Dr. Lee Kissup. "I believe that the earth is like an organism connected by a network. Through the birds, I've come to feel this very strongly."
Yeah.
Many ecologists and ornithologists view migratory birds as an ideal indicator species for tracking the health of global ecosystems. International conservation efforts were actually successful in recovering populations of black-faced spoonbills, which faced serious risk of extinction during the rapid economic development of East Asia and Southeast Asia in the 80s and 90s. But because the climate keeps changing and habitats keep getting destroyed, any recent success in wildlife conservation is at constant risk of being short-lived.
Mm.
In 2018, North Korea became the 170th country to sign on to the Ramsar Convention on Wetlands, naming two protected wetlands in North Korea to be of international importance for migrating birds.
Okay.
So with that, I might go on to the next song now.
Yeah.
With a bit of introduction. So in the 1970s, there was a young folk songwriter called Kim Min-gi. The albums he had written were actually banned in 1975 under Park Chung-hee's military dictatorship because his lyrics were considered to be negatively influencing societal values. So it was illegal to sing his songs in public or play them on the radio. His songs became very popular among the South Korean democracy movements of the 1970s and 80s, and eventually they were unbanned in the late 80s when South Korea won their democracy. So in 2021, there was a collaboration of Korean artists that made a 50th anniversary tribute album to Kim Min-gi. So this is a cover of one of his songs.
Mm.
Before I play the song, I want to read out a small translation of part of the lyrics, so maybe you can understand why Kim Min-gi's lyrics were so threatening to Park Chung-hee's military regime. "The flowers are blooming in the field, across from me are fragrant. I can almost hear you breathing as you stand there. Divided so close together like this, I just stare at the rusty barbed wire standing helplessly. Listen to the sound of raindrops falling. Children are standing around, crying, and dark clouds are gathering. Now put down the gun and hold both hands together. Take down the rusty barbed wire that stands helplessly."
Mm.
So this is Facing the Barbed Wire by Maitri.
"힘없이 서 있는 목숨 철조 stand in solidarity with Palestine this Sunday.
Hi, it's Nasser Mashni from Palestine Remembered, Australia's only dedicated show on Palestine. Join me every Saturday morning at 9:30, and very importantly, get along to our rallies. Sunday, 12 o'clock, State Library. Join us.
We have to mobilise to show our support for Palestine. 12 p.m, State Library, this Sunday.
Rally to demand freedom and justice for Palestine. No war on Gaza.
Free Palestine Melbourne is a 3CR supporter.
Freedom of Species thanks Animal Free Science Advocacy for their financial support of this program. Animal Free Science Advocacy works to create a future where no animals are harmed in the name of science. And scientific progress is advanced through animal-free research methods. Become a member today by visiting animalfreesci.org.au. That's animalfreesci.org.au.
Yeah, welcome back to 3CR with Freedom of Species today. My name's Trevor, and we've got Betty here as well. And we are talking about the Korean Demilitarized Zone, the DMZ. It's part one of a two-part show on this topic. And yeah, Betty, what was that last song that we heard?
The last song we heard was Facing the Barbed Wire by Maytree, which is a song by Kim Min-gi. So on the topic, I mentioned before that this music was actually banned at the time, that it was banned in 1975 for a few decades. And I've been researching Korean protest music a little bit for this episode. And I've been thinking there must be so many people around the world that write protest music and nobody or not many people get to hear it because of the regime that they live under.
Yeah.
But South Korea is kind of an interesting case because the regime changed. So now we get to hear the protest music that was written from that time period.
Yeah,
it's a totally different context to be writing protest music.
Isn't it? And again, that's another thing that sort of we see echoed in different parts of history when there's been colonization or genocide, and, you know, music is always a big part of it as well. And the banning, unfortunately, of you know, music as part of that, you know, cultural oppression. But we were talking during the break about your story about the migratory birds. And even though I don't know a lot about migratory birds, it was, and I guess maybe some listeners might know as well, if you're not familiar with them, but there are lots of other animals, obviously, that are migratory and do similar patterns, say like land animals. There are even non-bird species like bats, I know I've heard about. They've got migratory patterns up and down the East Coast. And obviously there's ocean dwelling animals that have migratory patterns. And yeah, we were chatting about like how you mentioned, it's really funny that geography historically only focuses on land or land and ocean, like a mixture of inanimate objects like things, so rocks and dirt and, you know, but also some living things such as trees and bushes and, yeah, marshes. And it's interesting though that cutoff happens at plants and animals are not considered at all in terms of geography. Like, I don't think there's probably many examples of different animal species or animal movement or animal habitation affecting where humans will arbitrarily cause a boundary or a border geographically.
Yeah, like we're kind of building the world as if we're the only animals on it.
Yeah.
And then we have these kind of nature reserve areas, sometimes intentional, sometimes unintentional. And yeah, but we don't necessarily set up the world so animals can survive. So,
and I never thought about it before because it's so obvious that, you know, we'll often a river or a mountain range or a desert will signify a boundary, but we never use animal patterns to signify boundaries. So it's almost like we're deliberately ignoring animal patterns.
Yeah, right. And then I don't know. This is another topic to get into, but we can definitely see that animals get blocked up sometimes by things that we build. And it's like, okay, well, this is a new boundary for them. Now they can't cross it because we built something here and didn't think about them.
Yeah.
Just like we always do, pretty much.
And I guess this is like, I guess, a bit of the general sort of topics that you're hoping to cover in a way is like how animals are involved or how they're currently not involved in our geopolitics and how they could be involved or maybe, you know, what it means when they're not involved. And that was just, yeah, that little chat that we had while that song was going, it really sort of blew my mind of like thinking, wow, yeah, we totally haven't even started to think about animals as part of the environment, really.
Yeah. In the future, I'd almost consider doing a whole episode on like animal-related infrastructure, like things that we have built to try to make life easier for animals. Yeah.
Or how successful we've been.
Yeah.
Or not, because sometimes we try and then it fails.
Yeah, yeah, that's true as well. So something that Kim talked about towards the end of the book was she was talking about during the 2020 lockdowns how animals actually started to show up in places like the streets and shopping centers and stuff because there were no humans there. And she was saying it was often framed as nature coming back as if it wasn't always there to begin with, right? Like returning from somewhere. Whereas like we're actually living amongst animal habitats. We just don't think that we are.
Yeah.
We just don't think of ourselves that way.
It was more the absence of the active aggression keeping them away.
Yeah, like we stopped keeping them out. So exactly. Then they turned up.
Yeah. And it's really funny that it's phrased that way or that we don't think of it that way, that it's, you know, it's an active ongoing forcing of animals out of suburban areas, of you know, highly populated areas, rather than just animals daring to come back when we're a bit quieter. They're sort of always trying. It's just we keep pushing them away.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. Instead of trying to coexist somehow. Yeah, it's really just we restrict them. Okay, so next week we're going to talk more about the Korean DMZ and I'm going to talk a bit more about life near the border and life near landmines and that sort of thing. But just to finish up today, I want to tell a story because we were talking a bit about World War II history before, and I want to connect this back to Australia for a moment to remember some important World War II heroes who often don't, or who didn't get the recognition that they deserved at the time. And that is the Aboriginal Tiwi Islander people. So today is the first day of NAIDOC week.
Yep.
So it's a good time to remember this history. And we talked a little bit about the Empire of Japan that was expanding from 1910 all the way up to 1945. Yep. So if you get a chance, have a look at the historical map of the Empire of Japan and you can see the land that was under Japanese occupation came all the way down to the island of Timor, which is not too far away from Darwin and the Tiwi Islands. Imperial Japan was concerned about Darwin's use as a military base, and that is why they bombed Darwin in 1942. So I found this story from an article, and this is told by his granddaughter, Marie Mankara. One night, Louis Mankara and his family of the Tiwi Islands witnessed an American military vessel being bombed near their island. They lit fires on the beach so that survivors could find their way back to land, and they made the survivors comfortable until they could be taken back to Darwin for medical treatment. Apparently, they also recovered large amounts of food and alcohol from the shipwreck, and they partied on the salvaged goods for weeks, which, you know what? So they should.
Yeah.
Whomst among us would have done different? So rest in power. I salute you, Louis Mankara and family. I hope it was a great party.
Yeah.
I also want to shout out three more Tiwi Islander heroes, Johnny Tundingali, Jabiru Kerenaiwa, and Diamond Kerenaiwa, who in June 1942 went out 70 kilometers in their canoes to rescue two American fighter pilots who they spotted parachuting down after a battle with the Japanese.
70 Ks in a canoe.
70 Ks in a canoe. I looked up a local reference point. If you could row from Port Melbourne to Geelong, that's 70 kilometers.
Whoa.
I think I get get tired driving that far, let alone rowing. My God.
That's incredible.
They then walked 40 kilometers to Darwin to get medical assistance for these American guys. So they risked their lives to rescue complete strangers.
Yeah.
Just because they could. So in total, the Tiwi civilians rescued 35 Allied force members during the bombing of Darwin. They got rewarded by the military with flour, tea, sugar, and tobacco. They didn't get paid properly for their national service. And the Australian government at the time didn't want to give them war medals because they weren't considered Australian citizens.
Yeah.
So it's not enough. They should get paid properly, or at least their descendants should. And they should be remembered as the war heroes that they are. So happy NAIDOC Week.
Yeah. It's so shocking that, you know, it just tries to get swept under the rug, basically. Like, hidden. And even what you said, like, what they were given, like, just reeks of, we're going to give you the absolute minimum to try and hope you go away and no one ever talks about it again.
Yeah, and I saw a little bit about, apparently they're trying to protect this shipwreck, actually, because it's kind of considered, like, it's right up on the beach and, yeah, it's considered, like, an important historic shipwreck, and the Tiwi Islander people want it protected as well. So hopefully it gets protected. And and I want these guys to be remembered.
Definitely. Well, thanks, Betty. Part one, that was really interesting. Part two is going to be next week. We are going to wrap up before Rotations comes in
with
our final song.
So the final song is called, I just want to give a quick lyric translation before we start it. So this is another Kim Mingyi song, and it's called The Thousand League Road. And it's about going home, I think.
Mm.
Leaves are passing by, water droplets are flying, kudzu vines tangled around our ankles, even if our path is blocked. A roe deer runs, a skylark is overheard. And on the other side of the rice field, a baby goat is playing. Let's go on a winding road of 1,000 miles. I'm going to my land, breathing in all the dust. So this is The Thousand League Road by Crying Nut.
Tonight. さね無事で撮った幸運の眠りでご羽が邪魔に言え出場よ별빛
listening to a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.